Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Alan Lichtman, a distinguished professor of history at American University, who has correctly predicted the outcome of every presidential election since 1984. We will discuss the latest Republican-leaning polls that show the president ahead, as well as the likelihood of wildcards upsetting Obama's path to re-election. Then we'll examine the reasons why Chicago's teachers have gone out on strike with Kevin Kamashiro, who is a professor and past chair of the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago. We will discuss his contention that Chicago's teachers are not striking because of money, but rather are protesting so-called reforms that have made their jobs nearly impossible. Then finally, we will speak with George Grayson, the author of Mexican Messiah, Andres Manuel López Obrador, about the resignation of the PRD's presidential candidate who is still contesting the last two presidential elections in Mexico. We will discuss whether López Obrador's exit from the Democratic Revolution Party to form a new political youth movement called Morena, the National Regeneration Movement, will divide and weaken Mexico's left. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, who's a distinguished professor of history at American University. He studied both the American right and the presidency, and his books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you, Ian.
And it looks like you're doing it again. You're getting it right here, Alan, because clearly President Obama got a substantial bounce from the convention, and Romney didn't get much of a bounce at all. And both the Gallup and the Rasmussen reports, both of which tend to favor Republican results over Democratic results, now show Obama leading Romney by 5 points on Gallup and 4 points on Rasmussen. So I imagine that there may be some premature elation going on at the White House.
Well, you know, as Yogi Berra once said, it ain't over till it's over. This election is not decided, of course, by the post-convention polls, although even better news for Obama, you mentioned the Rasmussen poll. It's now up to 5%. So all of the polls that have been out to this point do have Obama with a fairly solid, consistent 5% lead. And today's Ohio poll also has him up 5 points. In terms of the Electoral College, some of these swing state polls may be more important than the national polls. But as you know, the keys to the White House, my forecasting system that's hit 7 out of 7 of the past elections ahead of time, not retrospectively, doesn't even look at polls. In fact, I'm famous for saying, forget the polls, forget the pundits, look at the big picture. And I've been arguing since January 2010, I just dated myself, that despite the sour economy, that's only one factor. That when you look at the bigger picture, it strongly favors Obama's reelection. He's the sitting president. He's not challenged in his own party. He doesn't have a party split with a third-party challenger. He's achieved major policy change. He's had a big foreign policy success. He hasn't had a foreign policy disaster. Despite the hard economy, the country is not dissolved into social unrest. These big picture factors have been favoring Obama for a long time, and I think the Democrats finally got it in that they did something the Republicans didn't do at their convention. They talked about foreign affairs. They talked about America's place in the world, which is important and not irrelevant. Just because the Republicans aren't talking about it doesn't make it irrelevant. In fact, that shows why it is important. For decades, the Republicans have been pounding the Democrats on foreign and national security issues. Now they don't because the Obama record doesn't give them an opening.
Well, Alan Lichtman, there's been a complete reversal. The Republicans always owned national security, and the Democrats were always playing catch-up and apologizing for not being soft on the communists or soft on the terrorists.
The terrorists, right.
And conversely, the Democrats, who in Bill Clinton's case came up with the "it's the economy, stupid," that's now become Romney's entire campaign.
It's his only issue. his only issue now, he's down to being a one-issue candidate, is hard times are bad, therefore you need to change. He hasn't told us what he's going to do to fix the economy. Time and time again, he's been queried about his specific plans, and beyond tax cuts for the upper brackets and deregulation, which the Democrats have correctly said are the policies that got us here in the first place, he has no particular plans for fixing the economy, and the American people recognize that. He's even backed off some of his criticisms of the Obama health care program, saying, you know, well, maybe some parts of it, like those parts relating to pre-existing conditions, are pretty good. Of course, his right-wing base then practically revolted, and he had to eat his words. But kind of the emptiness of the Romney campaign was signified on Sunday when he was asked, all right, what tax loopholes are you going to close? He said, I'm going to close tax loopholes, so even though I am going to cut taxes on the upper brackets, they'll still be paying the same. He couldn't come up with one. Couldn't come up with a single example of a single tax break that he was going to eliminate. Look, if you're going to make a case, and there's a case to be made, as to why we have to change, it's not good enough simply to say things are tough. You've got to fit in the other half of the walnut, and that is, what are you going to do to make them better, and why should we believe you?
Again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who is a distinguished professor of history at American University. He studied both the American right and the presidency, and his books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Now, in terms of White Protestant Nation, Alan, what's happening to white Protestants? You've got a black man running, a Mormon running,
yes,
and two Catholics as VPs, and then you've got zero white Protestants on the Supreme Court. Something's happening.
Something is happening. This, of course, is the first time in the history of the Republic that there isn't a white Protestant on either major party ticket. That's absolutely extraordinary. And here's what's happening is white Protestant Nation is shrinking. We are becoming a nation of minorities. Texas is already a majority minority state, for example. It's 55% minority. Sometime in the next 20 years, Texas will turn purple once Latinos start voting. You know, Latinos, African Americans, Asian Americans are going to eventually, when they start voting, either dominate or certainly be competitive in Texas. If the Republicans can't have Texas, there's no electoral college map for them that wins for them. So I think over time, as white Protestants become a shrinking part of the American population and the American electorate, that makes it much more difficult for the Republican Party, which is now the repository of conservatism. That wasn't true for many decades in the early 20th century when there was plenty of conservatism among Southern Democrats, but they're gone. And so to depend upon white Protestants is very tenuous politically, and Republicans, if anything, have lost ground, not gained grounds with minorities. There was one extraordinary poll. I'm not saying it's accurate, but it's emblematic of Republican problems with minorities that had Romney getting 0% of the African-American vote. This is why you see all these voter suppression measures, voter ID laws, restricting early voting, purging the rolls, making it more difficult to register, because Republicans realize they can't expand their base, so they're trying to shrink the opposition base.
Well, but the asymmetry, Alan Lichtman, is that the white Protestants, they may be on the way out, but they're all going to show up and vote. I mean, there are 10 million eligible Latinos who haven't registered to vote.
And that's correct.
And we know that the young vote that came out in 2008 in a huge wave for Obama seems to be completely disengaged this time around. And you'd think that given the pernicious nature of the voter suppression that's going on the Republican side, at least that would motivate both the Latinos and the young to come out and vote. But it's not.
Well, we'll see. I'm not so sure that's true. The Latino issue on voting is a long-term structural one. A lot of Latinos are just becoming citizens. They're just getting used to being in the American political system. And it's not a constituency that's very well mobilized as yet. That's why I'm talking 20 years down the road for that constituency to be mobilized. And, of course, young people have always been the group that has the lowest voter turnout. Nonetheless, and voter suppression is obviously aimed at the more marginal peoples who tend to be Democrat. Nonetheless, you can only hold off these trends so long.
So what is your surefire prediction here for how things are going to pan out? As we started out, at the moment, things are looking good for Obama, and apparently the Romney team are kind of nervous, and they've just sort of sent a memo to themselves trying to buck up their spirits and say that we're not going to lose. So if we're already talking about not losing, then somebody saying that you are going to lose. I mean, it's not exactly the best situation to be in, but things could change. I don't know that they'll change with the first debate on October the 3rd, which is going to be on domestic policy. What do you think?
The keys don't change. The keys are the big picture. The keys are things like the economy, foreign policy successes and failures, social unrest, scandal, policy change, third parties. These don't change. And the keys have not really changed since I made my first prediction that Obama would be reelected in the International Journal of Information Systems in January 2010, more than 2.5 years ago. And the picture has not shifted at all despite all the politicking. The message of the keys is keep your eye on the big picture and don't be swayed by the day-to-day events. That's like looking at the froth on the wave when the tides are really deciding what's going on here. And the tides of politics have long called for and predicted an Obama victory despite the economy, because the economy isn't the only thing. Except for the economy, virtually every other factor that decides presidential elections goes in favor of Obama. And this is a nonpartisan system. This system has been right since 1984, 7 elections, and it has predicted about as many Republican as Democratic victories.
So, but obviously there are wild cards. So you mentioned scandal and foreign policy disasters. There's, of course, a persistent rumor, particularly buzzing in the Israeli press, that Netanyahu's determined to attack Iran and might well do so before the election. It looks like Obama dodged a bullet on the euro crashing.
Yes.
The ECB stepped up and is buying Spanish and Italian debt, even though the Germans are furious. That's probably going to delay the reckoning of the euro until after the election. And, you know, you can't discount the enormous amounts of money that the Republicans have at their disposal, a lot of which is anonymous. They can, you know, a billionaire can write a check for $1 billion.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a huge loophole in our political system. But there's nothing we can do about it without either a very different Supreme Court or amending the Constitution. We've got to live with that. There is no money key in the keys to the White House. Lots of candidates on the losing side of money have done very well. Franklin Roosevelt, when he got 60% of the vote in 46 out of 48 states in 1936, was soundly outspent by a guy we don't remember anymore, his Republican opponent, Alf Landon. The amount of money this time may make a difference. I mean, you know, the keys are based on historical patterns, and if the money gets great enough to break those patterns, things can get a little more unpredictable. But so far, historically, money has not decided presidential elections. You can buy other elections, mind you, but not presidential elections, for the simple reason that, you know, people don't know who this senator or congressman is, but everyone knows who's running for president. They get their message out. They have the conventions. They have the debates. People know who they are and basically, at least in broad strokes, know what they stand for. So it's very hard for money to turn an election. And it's not like the Democrats are broke. I just saw the statistic today that for the first time in a while, Obama in August actually outraised Romney. So Romney will have the money advantage because of the super PACs, but I don't think that's going to turn the election. That would only turn the election possibly if we had a repeat of 2000, you know, almost a tied popular vote and maybe one or two critical states decided by a few thousand votes. That's when you could see the voter suppression combined with the money making a difference.
Well, specifically, the Obama and Democratic Party raked in August $114 million compared to Romney's $111 million. But again, the enormous amount of advantage that the Republicans have with super PACs, and particularly with these 501c4 social welfare, believe it or not, PACs,
exactly.
where donors don't have to reveal who they are, and we don't know the extent to which corporate America, there's no question that corporate America is behind Romney. He's their guy, but we just don't know how much money they're pouring in. We do know that people like the Kochs and also Karl Rove are pouring enormous amounts of money into House and Senate races. So that seems to be, because we're so focused on the presidential race, my suspicion is that the Republicans will pick up more House seats and even more Senate seats, just based on money, not
It's possible. Money does make a difference in House and Senate elections. I haven't looked at, you know, the district by district, but I would be surprised if the Democrats took back the House. That's going to be very, very difficult, especially given the advantages Republicans have had in redistricting places like Pennsylvania and Texas. I think the Senate's going to be very close. You know, it could come down to Missouri, whether Todd Akin has put his foot so deeply in his mouth that he's going to choke on it through the election. That's not entirely clear, given the big Republican advantage in Missouri.
Well, what about, though, a foreign policy wild card? I've had some very interesting interviews with some fairly high-ranking people from the G.W. Bush administration who suggested that Netanyahu had actually come to the conclusion that Obama was going to win and would attack Iran just before the elections, but not, you know, to help his friend Romney, but to actually own Obama and lock him in to a policy that obviously Obama doesn't want to be a part of. But
I think there's some truth to that. I don't think an invasion, you know, in the days or weeks before the election will help Romney at all. It might actually help Obama for the simple reason that whenever there is a major foreign policy crisis, there is always kind of a rally around the flag effect, a rally around the leader. It's only over time when the policies, as they so often do, go sour, that there's a turn away from them. But the short-term effect is usually quite positive for the American president.
So is there anything that we're not thinking of here in terms of the wild cards? You've got the keys.
No, I don't think there's anything. The keys don't change. The only time in American history that the keys have changed this late in an election, you got to go back to 1864, the middle of the Civil War, rather unique situation, when Union victories, Sherman taking Atlanta, Grant's victories in Virginia, Sheridan's victories, did turn the situation around and did change some keys. But, you know, you got to go back 150 years and a Civil War to have anything like that. So, no, keys don't change late. And the way the system works, it's very hard for keys to change late. It would have to be, you know, a wartime situation or, as you say, something horrifically happening around the world.
But still, you've given us the caveat of money. Money has not been a part of the keys, and we are now in an entirely different money environment, are we not, with Citizens United and these 501c4 super PACs where donors don't have to reveal who they are, which I find deeply ironic given the voter suppression where people who want to vote Democrat have to prove who they are.
Right. Well, of course, we've had situations in the past before modern disclosure rules when no one knew who the donors were. That's, you know, a modern, you know, late 20th century kind of innovation. They had very loose disclosure laws before that, but, you know, a lot of campaign contributions, if we recall Watergate, for example, all that cash that was flowing, were not disclosed. I agree with you. This is a new thing, but there are always new things. You know, in 2008, people were telling me, your keys aren't going to work because we've never had an African-American nominee before. You know, so there are always new things. They're always changing. The keys, at least retrospectively, are based on elections since 1860 when, you know, women didn't vote. African Americans didn't vote. My ancestors from Eastern Europe weren't here yet. Latinos weren't here yet. There was no television, no polls, no jet planes, no prop planes, no automobiles. So the keys are what we call a robust system. They've held up through enormous changes in our politics, in our electoral system, in our economy, in our society. That's why I never change the keys based on something that seems to be new and unique to an individual election.
Well, Alan Lichtman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, it's been great fun.
Again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's a distinguished professor of history at American University. He studied both the American right and the presidency, and his books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll go to Chicago to talk about the teacher's strike.
Children well, their father's health did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kevin Kumashiro, who is Professor of Asian American Studies and Education at the University of Illinois, Chicago, where he was formerly the Chair of Educational Policy Studies. He is the founding director of the Center for Anti-Oppressive Education and president-elect of the National Association of Multicultural Education, and his research, teaching, and activism are redefining the field of anti-oppressive education as he develops new approaches to addressing issues of social justice in schools. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Kumashiro.
Thank you very much for having me.
And today in Chicago, 26,000 teachers have gone out on strike along with support staff, affecting 400,000 students. And this, of course, is pitting a democratically controlled city against its former union allies. When do you think this will be resolved?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. It's hard to say, you know. And I think it's hard to say because The strike is an unusual one that deserves our attention. Usually when we think about unions going on strike, we think about unions advocating for better compensation. And indeed, that was part of, that's part of any negotiation. But the interesting thing with this strike is that both the union and the Chicago Public Schools have made it quite clear that they came quite close to agreement on compensation. So the strike is actually not about compensation. It's about the belief among the teachers that the reforms underway are making it very difficult for them to do their job, right? In other words, it's a strike that's trying to push back on the larger reforms underway in Chicago public schools.
Well, in terms of pay, apparently both sides were close to a pay agreement after school officials offered an increase of 16% over 4 years on the average for most teachers. And the average teacher salary in Chicago is $74,839 for the 2011-2012 school year, according to the district. Now, that's going to strike a lot of people as being a fairly substantial wage.
Yeah, and I guess I would say several things, right? One is that the Chicago Public Schools is also implementing a number of changes, right? One of them being lengthening the school day. And I think that that was part of the struggle, is to say you're lengthening the day, you're increasing the work. How is that being balanced in terms of how we're compensating teachers, right? I also think, though, that when we talk about individual compensations, we sometimes lose sight of the bigger picture in terms of the overall budget, right? Salaries is one part of what we need to be talking about. Teacher salaries is one part. there are a whole bunch of other salaries that are part of this equation as well, right, that get factored into public school budgets. And then there's all the other things that happen in public education that are not only about salaries, right? You know, one of the things that the teachers union is trying to push back on is the idea that we are outsourcing a lot. Public school districts across the country are outsourcing more and more. And in fact, if to get the funds through a race to the top, you actually have to show how you're going to outsource, because it's a massive amount of spending in a short period of time, right? How are you going to hire companies to help you do all the things that you're trying to do? Outsourcing is becoming a bigger and bigger part of public school reform. And I think one of the things that they're trying to raise is, well, when we outsource, right, when we're paying other companies to do things, what is not being met? What needs are not being met by those funds, right? And one of those needs would be buildings, right? We have buildings that are in disrepair, where water is leaking through the roofs when it rains, and on the flip side, when it's really hot, some of these classrooms are getting into the upper 90 degrees, right? It's not just uncomfortable, it's just not conducive to teaching and learning, and not very healthy either, right? I think it's asking those broader questions about, well, what does the overall budget look like, right? How are we spending our money, and does the spending reflect the priorities that we should have as we think about what is best for our children?
So these reforms that you just mentioned, they come directly from the Education Secretary, Arne Duncan, who's the former head of the Chicago School District, right?
That's right, that's right. Arne Duncan, the now Secretary of Education, used to be the CEO of Chicago Public Schools, and some of the signature reforms of the Obama-Duncan administration, like Race to the Top, found its footing here in Chicago under what was the signature reform of Arne Duncan's time here, which is called Renaissance 2010. It was a plan to close, it was a turnaround school plan, right? It was a plan to close down about 60 or 70 so-called failing schools, open up about 100 new schools, and that was supposed to drive improvement. And one of the things that people often forget is that about a year before he released his plan, the Commercial Club of Chicago released their plan to improve public education or to reform public education in Chicago. It was a plan called Left Behind that basically laid the blueprint for Renaissance 2010. And I think this is not unusual, right? Throughout the past century, we've seen an increasing role of the business sector in terms of driving school reform, in terms of coming up with the ideas of what school reform should look like. And again, I think one of the questions that this should raise for us is, well, what's the basis for the decisions we're making around school reform, right? Is it profit? Is it looking at research? Is it a vision for what's best for our kids? And I think this is where the struggle is happening, right? That a lot of the reforms seem to be driven more so by profit than by the other things, like research, like a vision for what's best for our nation's kids.
Again, I'm speaking with Kevin Kumashiro, who's a professor of Asian American Studies and Education at the University of Illinois Chicago, where he was formerly the chair of the Educational Policy Studies. He is the founding director of the Center for Anti-Oppressive Education and president-elect of the National Association for Multicultural Education. And Kevin, you have said that the teachers are not striking primarily about money. They are striking to change the reforms that have made their jobs nearly impossible. So just, I know you've mentioned it before, but just specifically, what are the reforms that make their job impossible?
You know, one reform would be the turnaround policy, right? This is a practice that has been going on now for approaching a decade. And one of the things that the research is showing us is that, in the first place, the decisions about what schools to get closed are not often based on research that shows us that the schools are struggling, right? It's decisions that are not often based on with community input about what is best for their children. Sometimes decisions about school closing goes hand in hand with decisions around which neighborhoods are being gentrified at the time, right? So when we look at the impact that such policies are having, it should not be surprising that schools that are that the turnaround policy is actually not leading to the kinds of improvements that we want to see. One thing that we're seeing is that the schools that were struggling the most are not the ones that are benefiting, and that in fact they're ending up often in worse conditions, like with less funding, with less retention of students and teachers, with increased violence as students are now being forced to cross gang lines, right? These are some of the examples of how the turnaround policies is actually making teaching and learning more difficult. But there's also policies around teacher evaluation, and you may have seen that this is one of the big issues that is in disagreement between the union and the Chicago Public School District. Around the country, school districts and states really are moving towards teacher evaluation systems that are based primarily on student test scores. Right? And this is happening despite that testing expert after testing expert is telling us that student tests are helpful for some decisions, but they are neither valid nor reliable as a measure of teacher effectiveness and teacher quality, right? And yet, we're moving increasingly towards the use of student tests to make huge decisions, like which teachers get retained or punished, like which schools get turned around, you know, the so-called turnaround policy. So I think that's another thing that is showing us that we need to be paying more attention to the research. And just to kind of bring this back to your question, so how does this affect students? If we look at the proposals or the plan that the Chicago Public Schools is supposed to be launching this year around teacher evaluation, it is estimated that thousands of teachers could be negatively affected by a rating system that we already know is unreliable. Right. So if you had a rating system and you found that thousands of teachers are not very effective, then I would agree we need to do something about that. Right. We need to either give them professional development to improve, or we need to ask them to leave the teaching profession. But if the evaluation system isn't even reliable, then why are we putting so many jobs in jeopardy? Right. It's going to lead to an enormous amount of instability for the students in schools that we know are struggling the most. Right. So that's another impact. You know, and it kind of comes back to when people talk about the strike, they're quick to say, ah, the teachers are being greedy, they're just doing this for their own money, and it's disrupting the education of our students. Yes, in the short term, the strike is stopping schools. It's a disruption to education. But what's the long-term picture? Well, the long-term picture is that if we don't change the policies, the disruptions are arguably much more sustained, right, than what we're seeing with the strike. And I think that's the bigger picture that we want to keep in mind.
Well, Kevin Kumashiro, again, professor of Asian American Studies and Education at the University of Illinois Chicago, where he was formerly the chair of Educational Policy Studies. He's also the founding director of the Center for Anti-Oppressive Education. Give us a sense of what that means, anti-oppressive education, and how do you address issues of social justice in schools? You mentioned some of these so-called reforms that are forcing gang kids to cross gang lines. Isn't that a huge part of the problem if you have children coming from disadvantaged socioeconomic environments? What are the roles of schools today with kids like that? They are obviously being forced to be more than institutions for education, but they're also expected to be institutions for social remediation, aren't they?
There's a lot of roles being placed and expectations being placed on schools, absolutely. I think when I think about things like violence, and when I think about things like how violence in communities seep into schools, it reminds me that no reform of education can be thought about in terms of like a silver bullet. There's no one simple thing that can be done that's going to suddenly improve education, because education is tightly connected with so many other facets of life, right? It's connected to violence in communities. It's connected to poverty. It's connected to healthcare, right? You cannot expect students to learn if, you know, the story I like that I always remember is, you can't expect a student to learn if they're sitting in your classroom with a toothache, right? You can't expect students to learn if they're hungry. So the school reform has to go hand in hand with other kinds of reforms, absolutely. It doesn't mean that schools are supposed to solve all the problems. What it does mean is that you can't talk about school reform without talking about these other kinds of issues.
Well, just in closing, Kevin Kumashiro, this is clearly a political year, and this is clearly a political event that's going on in Chicago, given that Rahm Emanuel and Arne Duncan, both close to the president, are involved one way or another in this. How is this going to play out in terms of election politics?
That's such a good question, right? There are a lot of leaders in the Democratic Party, as well as leaders in the national offices of the unions, who did not want this strike to happen, right? It could hurt a Democrat. It could hurt the Democratic Party in this huge election year. But what are some thoughts that give this context? You know, there are many critics who are saying that the Democratic Party has taken for granted its labor constituent, right? Where was the Democratic Party when the onslaught over the past year and a half against the public sector was happening, right? And in fact, wasn't it some of the leaders of the Democratic Party that was encouraging people in places like Wisconsin to stop this public occupation, to move what was a social movement into electoral politics, right? Hey, let's end the occupation and let's try to vote to get them recalled. And there are some very smart analyses out there that says when you move from a social movement, which is about changing consciousness, and you move that into an electoral battle, right, voting to change law or to change who's in elected office, you lose something, right? You lose this larger goal of trying to shift the debate, of trying to shift public consciousness.
Sure.
And I think that's some of what we're seeing here, is that the unions are changing the rules of engagement, right? That we're, in some ways, we're seeing unions return to the strategies that defined union work half a century ago, right? Unions over the past half a century were changing their tactics. They were moving more and more towards electoral politics. And I think what we're seeing now is a shift where they're returning back to grassroots mobilization, to open sort of public resistance as a way to try to shift the consciousness, shift the conversation, and see if that impacts policies and practices in the ways that really do benefit our nation's young people.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Kevin Kumashiro.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Again, I've been speaking with Kevin Kumashiro, who's a professor of Asian American Studies and Education at the University of Illinois, Chicago, where he was formerly the chair of Educational Policy Studies. He is the founding director of the Center for Anti-Oppressive Education and president-elect of the National Association for Multicultural Education, and his research, teaching, and activism are redefining the field of anti-oppressive education as he develops new approaches to addressing issues of social justice in schools. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how López Obrador in Mexico has resigned from the PRD party to form his own new party that's likely to split the left in Mexico. Dealing with some issues that you can't believe. Single black female addicted to retail as well. And when it falls down, who you gonna call now? Come on, come on. And when it all falls down, man, I promise. And when it falls down, who you gonna call now? Come on, come on. And when it all falls down, man, I promise. I'm so selfish, my nigga, I'm mad. Dame, 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 dame todo el power para que te demos en la madre. Gimme, gimme todo el poder so I can come around to poder. Dame, 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 dame todo el power para que te demos en la madre. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is George Grayson, a professor of comparative politics at the College of William and Mary. He has written more than 20 books, including The North American Free Trade Agreement, Regional Community, and The New World Order, Oil and Mexican Foreign Policy, and Mexican Messiah, Andres Manuel López Obrador. He is an associate scholar of the Foreign Policy Research Institute and writes a weekly column for the Mexican magazine Milenio Semanal. His latest book is The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, Criminal Entrepreneurs, and the Shadow State They Created. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Grayson.
Very nice to be with you.
And AMLO, as he's called, Andres Manuel López Obrador, has stepped down from the leadership of the PRD party to form a new party. Not exactly a new party, but a new movement that may turn into a party called Morena, the National Regeneration Movement. And, of course, the first question that comes to mind, George, is will this split the Mexican left?
López Obrador has never really been a leftist. He began his political career some 30 years ago as a member of the long-ruling PRI, which dominated the country from 1929 until 2000. And so parties for him had been like Kleenex. When they're useful, he takes advantage of them. When they're not useful, he discards them.
So then when the former leader of the party, Jesus Ortega, the former national chairman of the PRD, says that although he hated to lose López Obrador, his departure would end the political schizophrenia. Is that what's been going on here, that this that he is exemplifies a kind of well, he's the lightning rod for a struggle between the more moderate and radical elements of the left in Mexico?
Well, he has his own group of followers who would walk through fire for him, and he has capitalized on his ability to mobilize crowds. Even though he's got a fairly small organization, he can fill up a plaza such as the Zocalo, the central plaza in Mexico City. And so the parties of the left, like the PRD, are reluctant to lose him, even though he has been an albatross around their neck, because he can bring people out to demonstrations.
So the fact that he you're suggesting that he's really not about ideology. What is he about, ego? Is that what you're getting at?
No, he really believes that he is a messiah, and that he has been called by some higher force to uplift Mexico's downtrodden. And he's been active in that pursuit for upwards of three decades. At the cost of a high price to him, his followers, and his family.
Well, somebody has to do it, George. I mean, it's a terribly unequal society. Ironically, the world's richest man is a Mexican, and he's apparently a big power broker in the PRI's comeback, is he not?
Carlos Slim has been quite close to López Obrador.
Really?
Because López Obrador was, as you know, mayor of Mexico City from 2000 to 2005. And there were a number of sweetheart contracts that were let. And in return, Carlos Slim helped to beautify the city, especially the colonial portion of this great old city. And so it's one of the many ironies of Mexican politics that at least the PRI, which has come back to power, views Carlos Slim as having been entirely too sympathetic to López Obrador.
So Slim is not behind Peña Nieto?
Well, everybody's behind Peña Nieto now because he's the president-elect. But no, the Peña Nieto forces, I think it's safe to say, are not pleased with the support that Carlos Slim gave to López Obrador in the recent elections.
So just to sort of finally, to pin down the relationship with the PRD and this leader, has he help the party or not, particularly his antics after the first time he lost. He lost only by a half of 1%. And we know that there's been an enormous history of elections being stolen, where Salinas stole the election from Cárdenas, and all of the votes were burned. So one can understand that kind of suspicion. But in many ways, it backfired. He didn't participate in the debates, which was a huge mistake on his part. And this time around, most people think that the 6% margin by which Peña Nieto won is fairly acceptable. Nobody really, except AMLO, is complaining about it. So I'm just wondering whether there are other people in the party that would do better electorally, or has he, because he can turn out crowds, is he better for the party or is he worse for the party?
Well, let me give you a British analogy. It's true that 6 years ago, López Obrador brought together a political grouping which is more a collection of tribes than a party. There's never really been a coherent left in Mexico. And if that very close election had been followed by his being a graceful winner or graceful loser, as the case may be, then he would have been well positioned to run in this past July election. But instead, he decided to anoint himself the legitimate president. He barnstormed the country for years, played footsie with the left, but also with other groups, and hoped to make a comeback. And now the people have had, or the left has had, enough of him. He's sort of like their Prince Charles. They're ready for him to recede from the scene and let the younger of Prince Charles' sons ascend to the throne. And the younger of those sons is of course Marcel Ebrard, who is the former or the outgoing mayor of Mexico City. And so now I think the left is probably going to coalesce around Ebrard as their candidate in 2018.
Again, I'm speaking with George Grayson, Professor of Comparative Politics at the College of William and Mary, and he's written over 20 books, including Mexican Messiah, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and his latest, The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, Criminal Entrepreneurs, and the Shadow State They Created. So let's talk then about this new movement that López Obrador says he's creating, which is called Morena, the National Regeneration Movement. What's its connection with the Yo Soy 132 student youth crusade that sprung up in response to Peña Nieto's and the Televisa and the media monopolies forcing the pre-candidate down their throat?
The youth crusade is a modeled group, quite variegated. When it began, it was launched by students from some of the most prestigious universities in Mexico. And since then, it's reached out to public universities and to state universities. But it's divided six ways to sundown in terms of ideology, in terms of leadership, in terms of objectives. And actually, if you look at that age cohort in terms of the July election that Peña Nieto won, about as many people under 35 voted for Peña Nieto as voted for López Obrador.
Well, of course, he changed his tune somewhat in protesting this last election, because he'd signed off on it, on accepting it, and nobody seemed to think that the actual vote was rigged. What happened there, of course, was vote buying and the enormous imbalance in media exposure, with the main 90% of television essentially devoted to the PRI. How is this new youth movement going to operate? Is it going to use social media?
The youth group is attempting to use social media, but it's virtually impossible for someone outside of Mexico's political system to influence incumbent politicians. And that's because there's no re-election. That's because party bosses make the nominations for public offices. It's also because the Federal Electoral Institute pours tens of millions of dollars into the coffers of existing parties. The original leaders of the Yo Soy 132 movement really wanted to get into the system. They weren't trying to overthrow the system. Nothing like the Arab Spring, where you had had violent repression and where you had a move to topple the leadership. These are what you call juniors or strawberries, many of whom are young, middle-class, well-educated individuals who want to find a place in the system, but not overthrow the system.
Well, let's just talk a little bit about AMLO, George Grayson, who you've written about in Mexican Messiah, Andres Manuel López Obrador, and you also have an article at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Mexico's Andres Manuel López Obrador, 2006 versus 2012 and beyond, available at CSIS online. In this article, you point out that at the age of 15, he accidentally killed his younger brother while horsing around with a pistol, a tragedy that he refuses to discuss even today. And then when he was nearly drowned while swimming near Palenque, where his family operated a small hotel. You know, it's amazing that the Salinas brothers, Carlos and his brother, the bagman, when they were young, they shot the maid, horsing around playing cowboys and Indians with a real gun. Isn't that extraordinary, that coincidence there?
It is, but Salinas was only five or six,
right?
Which by no means is a justification.
Right.
López Obrador was in his mid-teens, and I'm sure that you would need all the psychiatrists in Mexico to be able to examine what that impact had on his life. But it certainly changed it, and he absolutely refuses to talk about it. But after that, we found him more and more involved in social activism and trying to uplift the poor of the country. And he did so by living for 5 years with an indigenous population. He also shook his fist and mobilized people against Pemex, the national oil company, that had highly polluted his home state of Tabasco.
So how is that different, though, Kevin Kumashiro, from the broader issues that the American public face as the disparity in wealth grows, as our economy becomes more of plutonomy, and as our democracy is captured by an oligarchy?
I think it's absolutely hand in hand, right? Schools are playing a huge role right now in widening disparities, right? And I think we need to think about how do we reclaim education. Schools are playing a role in terms of widening disparities in large part because some of the central decision makers, some of the most influential people in school reform right now are people who are in many ways making schools into more effective sorting machines. Right. When I was talking about the Commercial Club of Chicago being incredibly influential in terms of laying the blueprint for reform in Chicago public schools, that is just one example of how money is driving school reform in this country. Corporations and businesses are one entity that is enormously influential. The Business Roundtable is yet another example of that, right, at the national level, influencing federal policy. But it's not just corporations. So we can name a whole bunch of corporations that are influencing education because it's so profitable, right? Public education is a $500 to $600 billion enterprise, right? There's enormous profits to be made. It's not surprising that corporations will be investing as a way to leverage their wealth. But it's not just corporations. It's also the huge philanthropies, places like the Bill Gates Foundation and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Broad Foundation, Walton Family Foundation, right? These are other entities that are leveraging wealth to impact education in ways that don't necessarily draw on research, and that often can lead to greater gains to those who invest, right? What we see is that this example that I'm painting of people who are leveraging wealth in ways that significantly impact education reform is actually indicative. It's actually shared. It's a shared experience with school systems around the world, right? So when we think about the Chicago public school strike, some people are asking me, well, you know, I haven't heard about strikes in a long time. It seems like we haven't had very many teacher strikes in recent years. What's going on right now? And I say, you know, yes, we have not seen, it seems like, teacher strikes very often. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why that might be happening. But the reality or the flip side of that is that once you step outside this country, there's a whole different picture to be painted, right? A quick scan on the web shows me that right now, teachers are collectivizing not around compensation, right? They're collectivizing, they're striking, they're speaking back against reforms that they believe are actually making schools worse, such as in places like India, Kenya, Australia, Swaziland, Slovakia, Sri Lanka, Colombia, Canada, right? The messages seem to be echoed that these are reforms like high-stakes testing, like profit-driven decision-making, right? Like censored curriculum, right? The same struggles that we're seeing in Chicago are struggles around the world that teachers are beginning to really act in powerful ways. And I think that is all the more reason to pay attention to those who are brave enough to speak out.
Well, just in closing, George Grayson, if Lopez Obrador hasn't really helped the PID much at the presidential level, the party's done pretty well in the latest congressional contest. They picked up 136 seats in the 500-member Chamber of Deputies and 28 seats in the 128-member Senate. So there's a chance that they can come back. It's always been amazing that the left in Mexico has never got its act together, but neither is, in many ways, the Democratic Party here, right? or the parties further to the left are almost in oblivion.
Well, to reiterate my analogy, the left in Mexico has had enough of Charles.
I see.
They don't want him to be their leader. They want William. And William is crystallized in the form of Marcelo Ebrard, a very attractive and successful outgoing mayor of Mexico City.
Well, George Grayson, I thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure is mine. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with George Grayson, a professor of comparative politics at the College of William & Mary. He's written more than 20 books, including The North American Free Trade Agreement, Regional Community and the New World Order, Oil and Mexican Foreign Policy, and Mexican Messiah Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's an associate scholar of the Foreign Policy Research Institute and writes a weekly column for the Mexican magazine Milenio Semanal. His latest book is The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, Criminal Entrepreneurs, and the Shadow State They Created. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.